Gives me great pleasure to introduce Jim Wallace to you. I keep wanting to say ladies and gentlemen, but that would be inappropriate. feel free if you want to turn seats around. Jim's going to speak for a while and then he's happy to take questions and comments. He's going to speak from just up behind me here, where Rob's trying to get through. But we've got microphones that we can bring around during question time. It's been a pleasure just meeting Jim over dinner, and we've just discovered we've got a mutual friend. So the world isn't all that big, is it? Jim tells me he was, first of all, born in Queensland and now lives just outside Canberra and really resonates with Western New South Wales, loves the colours there and the sort of home of some of the Australian mythology. He's spent over 30 years in the army, serving his country in many different ways and rising to the level of brigadier, and was even offered higher honours than that, but decided to stop his military career about 6 years ago. At the top of his military career, he was in charge of the Special Services, SAS, and was also in command of all the tanks for us. And what was the other thing? There was a third thing you were in charge of. Special Forces. It's all military code. I'm sure that is very important and very complicated. But in charge of many men and women, presumably, much hardware, and with a very complex life and complex job. About 6 years ago, Jim felt a call of God on his life to stop that great career that he'd had and to come out and become the leader of what is called the Australian Christian Lobby. And I think you might have a pamphlet on your table about that. Jim is married and has two grown-up daughters in his early 20s. So it's great, Jim, that we're hearing about men under pressure, under stress, from someone who's obviously been under a lot of stress in your life. And not only that, but you've been a family man and had to balance that while no doubt having to travel and be away and maybe even had your life at risk at different times. So would you please welcome Jim Wallace.
Thanks a lot. Well, thanks very much, Peter, and thanks very much for your welcome. I do appreciate it. There's no doubt, men under pressure, good topic for me tonight. I got to the plane, you know, I had my normal bag that I carry on as luggage, and they said, no, you're going to carry that bag on, got to go to the next flight. You know, so I was under pressure to get here tonight, so it's perhaps fortuitous that I've got a little bit of experience of it this afternoon. I also realised, though, that we're not the only ones under pressure, men, because my wife, as I was packing to come down here, saw me go to the drawer, pick out the singlet and the undies, you know, and put them into the overnight bag. And she said, I wish I had one of those male drawers. And I said, what do you mean? Because we've got a chest of drawers. We've got two drawers each. They're both exactly the same. I said, what do you mean? She said, I have one of those mail drawers that just fills up by itself automatically. So I think she was telling me that women might be under more stress. I am very happy to be there, though. I really enjoy talking to men's groups. My wife thinks there's something deeply wrong with me, of course, for that. And I think it might be that I come from this all-female family. I've got a wife who's a female, which you've got to say these days, and I've got two daughters. And I thought, this is no good. I thought, I'm going to have to do a blokey thing, you know. So I went out and got a Rottweiler. I thought, that's a pretty blokey thing to do. The blinky thing was a female. Couldn't win. But we're going to talk tonight, and I've been asked to address this issue of men under pressure. And I've got to tell you, I'm still under pressure myself. I blew a sort of capillary in my eye last week. I was sitting there talking. Actually, I was in Sydney last weekend at speaking at some churches. On the Saturday night beforehand, I was having dinner with the pastor of Shire Christian Centre. And as he was sitting there eating, and we hadn't met before, he said to me, he said, look, he said, I don't know how to tell you this, but he said, your right eye is filling up with blood. And I said, oh, you got to be kidding me. I went and had a look, and it was. It was true. And later on, he said to me, he said, you know, he said, I just didn't know how to take this, because he said, I've never had dinner with an SAS bloke before. And he said, I thought maybe the eye filled up with blood, the hair came onto the back of the hands, the fangs dropped out. He said, I thought this might be normal. So I certainly, even today, in the job with the Australian Christian Lobby, you know, anybody, and many of you will have, I'm sure, grown a business. And that's essentially what we're doing with the Australian Christian Lobby, is going out and having grown a business from nothing, a small business, in a secular sense, you know, one sense of it. And of course, I operate with the Australian Christian Lobby at a very high level into Parliament, and you've got to be right, you've got to get your facts right, and so there's a lot of pressure in that as well. So, although I'll talk mainly about the military side of it tonight, or draw analogies and lessons from that, I certainly don't pretend for a moment that I've escaped or mastered this stress thing completely. I think it is true that men are under pressure for particular reasons at this stage in the development of mankind or of community. There's no doubt that you know, the very role of men is confused at the moment. And a role which used to be pretty specific: the man was the head of the house, the man was the head of the church, the man was expected and looked to be the leader, is confused these days. And you know, there's no doubt, I think, that we all feel at some stage or other some pressure from that confusion in society. Of course, and it's not just for men, as I illustrated with that story of my wife, it is for women too, but I think particularly for men, the very pace of life, as we know, adds a heck of a lot of pressure. And there is a sense, I know this is a sexist thing to say, I'll be told, if it was a group of women, but there is a sense that a woman can drop out of the workforce, at least for a period of time, to have a bit of a break. But whereas a bloke, by and large, can't. And a bloke, by and large, has to keep in there and at it in order to put food on the table for the family. So I think that the pressures of men, in particular, in this faster lifestyle that we have, this more demanding lifestyle that we have, are much greater and particular. And we see that, I might say, in the very high suicide rate of men. If, you know, if we were at all in doubt that men are under pressure, we've only got to look at that. And we look at it for rural, young rural men in particular, it's really amazing. I was told the other day that one farmer suicides each week in Australia. Imagine that, you know. So these blokes are under pressure. And certainly the general suicide rate among men in Australia is still too high and indicative of the pressure. And I think too, and I'll talk on a little bit, that there's no doubt that we as fathers and as husbands are under pressure. The norms of family life, the norms of family, the norms of father's role perhaps in family are changing or threatened. And at the same time, this unit called the family is under all sorts of pressure. And I think fathers very much, if they're not, should be taking that pressure on themselves, should be looking to address the pressures that family are under. And as I said, I'll talk about that just a little bit later on. Now, first of all, so that you get to know me, I suppose, and where I'm coming from, I'll just give you my testimony. And those of you who are Christians or church people will know that a testimony, of course, is our story of what God has done in our life, right? God has done for us. And sometimes when we give our testimony, we get pushed up there and God gets pushed off to the side somewhere, you know? So I do want everyone to realise that I'm talking here about what God's done for me and in my life. I was actually born in Sydney, which I know doesn't win any points down here in Victoria, but I wised up quick, but I didn't go south. I went north, as Peter said, and went up to, in fact, the northern rivers of New South Wales initially. I'd gone up there, I was only four, I didn't have much say in it, but I went up there because my father was wanting to soldier farm after the Second World War. He'd been a professional private soldier, you know, he'd one of these blokes, joined up day one, professional private in the front line at Tobruk, where the Germans were first beat on land, and front line at Milne Bay, where the Japanese were first beat on land, sorry, the Panzers were first beat on land in Tobruk by the Australians, and then Milne Bay, Japanese first built on land, defeated on land. And so he went through Buna, Balikpapan, all these, and he deserved a soldier farm. And he went up there to wait in a place called Moolumbar on the Tweed River for one of these things to come up in an area we were looking at going to. But as it turned out, the Tweed River, if you know it, floods, you know, and it flooded when we bought two shops that we were put our money into while we were waiting for a farm to come up, washed them away, slick solicitor took the money and we lost it all. So we went out to this little place called Telgham at the bottom of Mount Warney, just a little village, and where we were hoping, would have hoped to farm, and lived there anyway. We lived there about 6 years and then went up to Brisbane. But the problem was we never actually recovered from this loss of money, you know, that Dad had lost everything. And try as he might, Dad went broke another couple of times, and on the second time went broke to the extent that we had to move into a migrant hostel. It wasn't because we were migrants, it was because we were broke. And people say to me, that must have scarred you, you know, and I suppose in a sense it probably should have, because we were split up as a family. My mother and daughter, mother and sister were in one part of the hostel. Dad was off travelling salesman and I was with another bloke in another part of the hostel. So, and we were there for 2 years, so I suppose it wasn't all that good. But I must admit, it never scarred me. I thought it was terrific. As a young 11-year-old, 13-year-old, I used to go through the place like you're in the army every day to get my meals, and I thought it was terrific. I had dart boards, I had table tennis tables. I thought it was a great place, actually. But I think that what it did teach me, that sort of experience, was that if I wanted anything, I had to go out and grab it, you know. And so I became a grabber, you know. I became someone who thought that I really had to make it for myself. And so by the time I got to high school, and the last year in high school, I grabbed every leadership role in the school. I was the school captain, the house captain, the form captain, the cadet under officer. I grabbed them all. And I know about down here in Victoria, but they used to give us these ties with these little metal badges on them. Well, mine tore the weight. And I went off to Duntroon, where I just found something that I did, you know, I warmed to as soldiering. And I was pretty chuffed with myself. I went back up on leave, my first leave from Duntroon, and met with some friends of mine who I had been at school with, and they'd become Christians in the time I'd been away. And they were trying to convince me that I should ask Christ into my life. And I listened to them, and then I said, no, you fellas, and it was a girl there, you fellas, you just need a crutch. I don't need a crutch, you know. I can do this by myself. And then the girl actually came back and she said, well, she said, you know, she said, okay, we can't convince you. But she said, if Christ really did come down from heaven, give up heaven, in order to win for you this incredible prize of salvation. And in doing that, he died this incredibly excruciating death on the cross, which we've all got a vision of now, because of, thanks to the Passion. But we still can't even imagine the pain of the separation from God for Christ. But still, this excruciating death on the cross. She said, don't you think if Christ did all that for you, he might be weeping at your rejection of this great prize that he won for you at such great cost that you're now rejecting? Don't you think, she said, he'd be weeping at your rejection of it? Well, I went back to Duntroon and I just couldn't get this image of Christ weeping over my rejection of this great cost, a great prize. And so after about a month or a month and a half there, I got down on my knees and accepted Christ. And what I found, of course, is that sure, Christ is a crutch for us when we need it. And, you know, that's when men under pressure, you know, we need a crutch. And I tell you, I've served the toughest blokes in the world, commanded the toughest blokes in the world. And everybody needs a crutch at some time, okay? It's not a sissy thing to need a crutch. But for me too, Christ was much more than that in my life. In that, what I found was that Christ knows the vehicle. He made this vehicle, you know. And so as the maker of the vehicle, he knows how many gears it's got. He knows what it does in each gear. And he knows how to take it out and get the best out of it. And so what I found was that having Christ in my life actually opened up my life to achieve a potential that I personally would never have been able to achieve on my own. And I know that when I was 4 years old, I think it was a relatively sort of common thing in those days, but I had those irons on my legs, you know, and the big chunky, jumpy boots, you know, and I think I had them on for about a year, I'm not sure exactly. But if someone had said to my mother, he's going to command the SAS regiment one day, she would have just laughed her head off, you know. But see, Christ can take us out to places that we can't see if we put our trust in him. And so that's what I found as in terms of my life with Christ. And for me, those two things together really epitomise, I suppose, the basic principles or the basic advantages of Christ in your life to handle life as a man under pressure. But what I would like to speak about, and I'll leave my testimony there for a while, but what I'd like to speak about specifically is two aspects of that, which I think are really relevant to this this issue of men under pressure. And that is that we have to realise, people are under pressure these days because they don't realise the creative order of things. The fact that God actually created things, that we are a spiritual being. You can't address the problems of something under pressure if you're not looking at the reality of what you're dealing with, you know? And the reality is we're a spiritual being, and I'd like to talk about that a bit. And the second thing is that certainly for men under pressure, that the answer for men under pressure is to find peace in that pressure. And once again, I'd just like to talk to you about some examples that I believe are very relevant of Christ giving peace in those circumstances, or in pressurised circumstances. I might say, on something I meant to say right before the testimony, is that now I mentioned to you there that that we tend to, in testimonies, you know, throw ourselves up, you know, and God gets pushed off to the side. I've been extremely lucky having this all-female family, because those of you who've got lots of females in your family will know that they tend to keep your ego under control, you know. And mine do that very well. I was commanding the SAS regiment, and, you know, to be part of the SAS regiment is absolutely fantastic, you know. And I guess it's, you get a bit of a swelled head just being part of it. It's a magnificent organisation. But to command it was just an incredible privilege. And I guess I had a bit of a swelled head because I was driving past the regiment one Saturday on a day off. My daughters, then 6 and 3, are sitting in the back seat of the car. And as we're going past the main gate of the regiment, my 3-year-old in the back says, "Daddy, do you really own all the men in there?" And before I could say anything, the 6-year-old said, "No, Becky, he just thinks he does." I'd like to talk first then about this issue of realising that we're a spiritual being. You can't fix anything unless you look at the reality of your situation and the reality of what you're dealing with. I know, as a student of military history, that throughout the ages, the generals who have failed, the military commanders who have failed, have mainly failed because they've refused to look at the reality of the battlefield that was in front of them, you know? And one of our problems, one of the reasons that we're under so much pressure as human beings and as men in society today, is because we're not recognising that we are a spiritual being. So if you don't recognise that reality right at the start, you can't fix the problem. It's like looking at a car that's got something wrong with it and not recognising it's a car. You're never going to fix it if you don't recognise what it is, you know? Because your just solution is never going to match the problem. And if you think about it, you know, the fact that we are spiritual beings is deep in our vernacular as Australians. When the team that's at the bottom of the pile gets up and beats the team that's at the top of the pile, what do we say? We say, "That was a spirited performance," don't we? Yeah? Because we're recognising that what made the team that should never have won get up and beat the team that won was something inside them. And you can cut them in half. You can cut, I know down here it's 18, so it's a lot of blokes to cut in half, but you cut these 18 blokes in half. See, 13, only 13 in rugby league. 18 blokes all in half, and have a look at them inside, and you won't find what it was that made the blokes who shouldn't have won, win. But what it is, it was something inside them. And it was usually, and this is where leadership, an understanding of leadership, relies on understanding that we're spiritual beings. Because usually it's a leader who got inside these blokes and manipulated that spirit in a positive sense, you know, and caused them to play above themselves, you know. So everyone who's into leadership, real leadership, understands that he's dealing with a spiritual business because he's trying to motivate spiritual beings. And so it's very, very, very important in leadership. It's very, very important, and it's borne out in our vernacular that we are spiritual beings. I came face to face with this, and I think the SAS regiment did, when we had one of our fellows very badly wounded in training. Now, people say to me, you know, is the SAS regiment the best in the world? And you can't say that because special forces around the world all do slightly different things. So you can't say that one is the best, you know, because they're all slightly different. It's like apples and oranges. But what I can tell you is that the SAS regiment, and I don't know what the figures are now, but I know that by the time Afghanistan was over, that the SAS regiment had killed about 1,300 enemy, right, through Borneo, South Vietnam and Afghanistan, and Timor, about 1,300 of the enemy, and had not lost a single man on man to the enemy. Now, I don't think there's another force in the world that could claim that. That is incredible. Shows amazing battle skills, amazing battle discipline, not walking on tracks, not walking where you're going to be ambushed, all this sort of stuff. Amazing discipline. And the thing about it is, though, that the regiment only achieves that because it has this philosophy, if you like, which is train hard, fight easy. Train hard, fight easy. And so all the training that's done in SAS is done really realistically. It's done with live rounds. It's done absolutely realistically, and particularly with counter-terrorist training, because they're on such a short notice to move that we know that we can't go away and suddenly top blokes up to a battle readiness level. They've got to go straight away, you know. We've only got the time that it takes us to pack up and move to the place we've got to be. So therefore, the blokes are at that level all the time. And what it means is that while on the rock in SAS, I think at the moment there's about 44 names of fellows who've died since the regiment's been around. But of those 44 names, there would only be, I think it's about 7 that have been lost in combat or in operations. And those have been all lost by accidents on operations. One gored to death by an elephant in Borneo. There was a couple of blokes, or three blokes, I think it was, drowned crossing a river. There was a couple of shot by ourselves, you know. But they were accidents, you know. And one bloke trod on a mine in Afghanistan recently. But all the rest lost in training. And so, you know, SAS is a pretty sort of rugged place to be, and you get a high rate of injury, because obviously if you lose that many in training, you're getting a lot of blokes just below that who are very badly injured. And when I was commanding the thing as a commander, I'd served in it before, of course, and I'd had blokes die under me under training, but we were sailing along, and I was in my third year, last 6 months, and we hadn't had anyone die in training. And I just thought that the place was starting to get complacent. And so I actually had a test for everybody of all their safety. So if your skills were in diving, you did safety. If it was safety for diving, if it was demolitions, it was safety in demolitions. You got tested in the whole lot. And some of these blokes are all multi-skilled. Some of them sat there almost all day. It was like university exam. Because I told them that anyone who fails this is going to lose his special forces allowance, which is a big amount of money. So with that incentive, everybody passed it, except the cook. A cook failed it. But he wasn't an SAS bloke, but he failed it. But I was very pleased with that result, and I just signed it off, just signed the result off and put it in my outro. I was sitting in my office, and I get this telephone call straight away, which told me that there'd been a horrific accident up at Kalgoorlie, where the blokes were doing demolitions training with, and one of the things they were doing with was with these jumping mines, M16 jumping mines, a Vietnam vintage mine. They leap up in the air and they throw out ball bearings in a 360-degree circle. And we don't use those as the army normally does. We use them for ambushes, because we've got to get a real big impact on an ambush, because there's only a few blokes there, and so we've got to get the maximum effect on an ambush. And so to do that, of course, you've got to play with the ammunition, though, to remotely fire it, and that's the dangerous part. And this thing, when the blokes were walking away from it, went off, and we should have had a lot more casualties, but as it was, we got just a few flesh wounds, and one bloke, though, took the cut his backbone and got these ball bearings in the back of his head. He was flown down to Perth, and I shot up there to see what had happened. And once I was up there, I asked how he was, and they said, "Oh no, he'll probably die, but he may end up a quadriplegic. That's the best thing." So I rang up. I was talking to my second in command as he gave me the report on that, and I said, "Well, look, I'm sick of going to memorial services for these blokes. I said I want to have a healing service." Now, for the CO of the SAS regiment to say, I'm going to have a healing service, you know, it's like Sir Humphrey would say, bold move, CO. But nonetheless, the second-in-command was a good Catholic fellow, understood we'd been together for years, and he said, okay. And I said, I want you to make sure that nobody's forced to go to this, but have it ready at 9 o'clock when I come down tomorrow. So I went back the next morning, met the second-in-command, met me at the gate, and I started to walk up towards our little chapel, and he said, I know, boss. He said, we're in the gym. And I went into this gym, and I tell you, and I can't tell you how many blokes are there, because you're not allowed to know how many blokes in the SAS, and I'd have to cut your throats, you know, it'd be a bit untidy. A bit untidy at a Christian function. But this gym was full of blokes, you know, and blokes who had every right to believe and were the most independent, self-competent fellows that you could imagine. And yet they'd come there because they wanted to help their mate, but they couldn't, they had no way to do it. They didn't know how to do it. And so they came there to take part in this healing service, which was extremely foreign to most of them. And I told them what a healing service was, and the chaplain conducted it. And I tell you what, those blokes didn't all go out and become Sunday school teachers, although some of them went out and became pastors, funnily enough. There are two of them at least I know, pastors now, one of them in Canberra. But I tell you what, there was nobody there who didn't understand we're a spiritual being, because you could have cut the air with the spiritual sense in that room at that time. Absolutely amazing. And I get the hairs on the back of my head go up when I talk about it, because it was the most spiritual moment of my life beside my actual conversion, personal conversion. So I certainly realised, if I needed to, at that point, that we're spiritual beings. And these blokes certainly realised it too. You could have cut the air, the spiritual air. As I said to you, and something that's really relevant to us as men under pressure, is that leadership is all about understanding that we're spiritual beings. And of course, each of us in a family, for those who have families and are fathers of families, are leaders of our family. And I think that a lot of the pressures that we end up with in family is because we don't lead the family well. And yet that leadership of that family is very much on a par with the hardest leadership job in the army. Because the hardest leadership job in the army is a corporal's job. Everybody knows that. Because a corporal has to be there cheek by jowl with those he's leading. They see him every day. They see his weaknesses, you know. The corporal has to maintain the respect of these people and yet be able to ask them to do really tough things. And really, when you think about it, a father's in exactly the same situation. An SAS patrol with its corporal is put out in a really foreign environment or harsh environment, because it's put out behind the enemy's lines where everybody's against it. And I tell you, sometimes these families that we're in, if we want to maintain Christian values in those families, are in exactly that situation when they're out there in the world. And I think that the job of fathers in leading this family unit is very much equal to this job of a corporal, the hardest job in the army. And yet we don't train farmers in it. And I think that if we are spiritual beings, and if leadership at its heart is about understanding that, then what leadership is about is about communicating with people through the eyes, about being able to talk to them and get down inside to that spirit which we're actually leading. You know, a corporal in the battlefield can't ask 10 men to attack a machine gun by appealing to their heads, because it's really dumb. We only ask 10 blokes to attack a machine gun because we know that only seven will make it. So he can't appeal to their heads. What he's got to do is reach down inside them. He's got to grab their spirit, their heart, and get their heart to take them, or grab their spirit, get their heart to take them where their head wouldn't. You know, this is leadership. And what I suggest to you is that as fathers, if we're going to take the pressure off ourselves and be good leaders of the family, then we've got to make sure that we're in a position, we put ourselves in a position to communicate with our families all the time, communicate with our kids. I was reading something just on the plane down here that said, you know, leadership, real leadership, is about getting people to follow when they have another option. And you think about it, our kids have got plenty of other options, fellas. You know, our families, even our wives these days, if society's norms. You know, you saw this this thing this week where a bloke sued because it turned out the kids he was playing his maintenance for were not his. And the court says, oh, none of our business. In other words, that's all right. Yeah? That's all right. That's societal norm now. Wives and kids have got other options these days. So we've got to be good leaders and we've got to be there communicating with them and giving them time, okay, if we're going to relieve the pressure that's on families. I'll just speak quickly about this issue of peace because this to me is really important. If we are going to succeed as men under pressure, we've got to find peace in all the various situations that we find ourselves. This peace thing for me really came to a head, or I really, I suppose, grasped it, understood it, when I was doing the SAS selection course. The SAS selection course is the most mongrel thing you ever want to do in your life, believe me. It's not something you want to do twice. I think on the first 3 days of ours, we ran 70 kilometres, mainly with webbing or packs and rifles and in boots. The idea is in the first week that they rip, just rip you down physically, get you really, really tired, so that the next week they can really test you. Then they rip all the facades off, you know, so you can't put up a false facade and they can see the real person inside. And so that first week, we got 10 hours sleep. You know, I mean, 7 days, 10 hours sleep. I tell you, you get 10 hours sleep in 7 days, you are tired. I sort of look at this torture stuff they talk about, sleep deprivation, and I think, come on, you blokes, I've been through all that. I'll sue the Australian government then. But you get so tired that you start hallucinating. I was walking behind a fellow as the last man in a patrol on an exercise. It was about the sixth day without sleep. And or we might have snatched sort of about 2, 3, 4 hours in that time. And as we're going up the hill, 1 o'clock in the morning, this bloke goes like this. And I leaned over and I said, what are you doing? He said, I'm opening the gate for you. Went about another 2 hours on, and the bloke, the first scout, calls the patrol commander up, see? And the patrol commander's the only one awake in these situations, really, really awake, because he's got that extra adrenaline of being in charge. And the first scout says, look, he's pointing to the top of this West Australian hill, 3 o'clock in the morning, and the patrol commander says, what, I can't see anything? And he said, yes, you can. He said, the church and the steeple and all the nuns. And I thought, boy, I'm going to do all right here. These blokes go mad, you know. And then the next morning, I was handed the command of the patrol, and the sun was up now, and I was being given my orders. And as I'm being given my orders, there's a bloke behind me who leaned against a tree and just crumpled on the ground to sleep because he just couldn't stay awake. And they told me I was to put an ambush in. You've got to keep blokes awake. Let an ambush go off. And it was an ambush on a little creek, which was only about from here to that wall wide, a West Australian creek, not a lot of water in it. And they told me the enemy was going to come up or down this creek in rubber boats. So I laid the blokes down. I thought, I've got to stay awake because these blokes won't. I know they won't be able to. And so I sat on my pack and I'm physically holding my eyes open like this to try to see this creek, you know. And I thought, I'd better see the boats coming up or down this river early enough to wake all these blokes up. So I looked down the creek and all I could see was a Manly ferry steaming up this creek, you know. Didn't matter what I do, I couldn't see the creek. So I thought, this is no good, I better hope they come the other way. So I looked down the other way and all I could see was penguins on ice. Middle of West Australian bush, you know. So I just had to look straight ahead. But you know, for all the torture, that physical torture that the course was, and it was, I realised that there was a greater pressure on people. And I was walking with a bloke, just two of us, and he was a bloke I knew well. We'd come from the same battalion. We're on an exercise you did in pairs. And I said to this bloke, I said, how are you going? He said, I'm not doing too well. He said, I think I'm going to fail. I said, why is that? He said, I think at that last checkpoint, he said, I think I got the thumbs down from the instructors, you know, or the assessors. And I suddenly realised that for all the physical pressure, that the real pressure on everybody on that course was the pressure of perhaps failing and having to go back, because as soon as you failed, you're off. That was it. You were gone. Just disappeared like smoke. Boom. And back to your unit. Return to unit. And they'd have to go back and explain to blokes who couldn't possibly understand what they'd just been through, explain why they'd failed this course. And that was the real pressure. And yet, I got to tell you, I felt at that moment that I was sailing through this thing because I didn't have that pressure. I didn't have it because in the weeks leading up to it, a series of events, which I won't go into, had occurred, which made me realise that I was meant to be on that course, that God wanted me on that course. And so for me, and it's been all my life, that the great sense of peace, the greatest sense of peace, the greatest answer to pressure, has been knowing that you're in God's will, you're in God's purpose, and you're where God wants you to be, you know? And if we've got that sense of being in God's purpose, God's will, and where He wants us to be, then you really can get peace in almost any situation. And I'll talk tomorrow at the church, for those who'll be at St. Alfred's, about a situation in Lebanon, which was a lot more pressurized, life and death type thing. But again, it was the peace of knowing that you're in God's purpose and will, you know. And so that to me is the greatest thing. I will say though that if we are in that situation, that what we've got to do, if we grab that peace in the first instance, we've got to hold on to it, okay? We've got to hold on to it. And there's all sorts of stories. There's one of a fellow who was in the 22 SAS, the British Army. He was a fellow who'd always been in trouble at home. He'd always been in trouble with the police, and then he joined the army. Now he's in trouble with the British police, the military police. He went and did an SAS selection course and came through it and just found his place. He was a really good soldier. Was in the Iranian embassy siege, doing well. Became a Christian. Terrific witness, I thought, as I read this book. Then he got out and became a Anglican curate. And I thought, terrific witness, you know. And then you keep reading and the book stops, because they found him that he'd gassed himself in his car, you know. And I don't know what demons went through that bloke's head, but what I do know is it's not enough to just grab the piece. You've got to hold on to it, you know. We've got to hold on to it, you know, once you've grabbed it. Look, I'll conclude there. So we've got some time for questions. I'm sorry, I've probably gone on a bit. And just say that to me, the secret of being men under pressure and succeeding to overcome, in overcoming the pressures that are there, you know, we're just fools if we deny them, is that first of all we realise that we are a spiritual being, and if we're going to try to address these problems, then that's the start point. We've got to realise we're spiritual beings and we're in a spiritual world. And that the second thing is that if we are going to know the peace of God, then the secret to it in any situation, whatever pressure we're under, is to know that we're in God's purpose and will and in where He wants us. Because He tells us He'll be there behind us, you know. And so it's a great source of peace in any pressurized situation. I think I'll leave it at that and perhaps give people the opportunity to ask questions.
How about we give Jim a big round of applause first? And as Jim alluded to, he'll be speaking at our two morning services tomorrow on a very thorny topic with a state election coming up, and it's called Getting Godly Government. That's one of the other things Jim knows a little bit about. I'm just going to wander around. If you'd like to make a comment or ask Jim a question, then just alert me and I'll give you this microphone, because we're taping this, so it'd be helpful just to get your comment or questions as well. Okay. Somehow I'll get through.
Jim, you said at the start there that men are confused. It seems to me, and I'm a father of four children, and my youngest son has just finished doing his VCE, so we've now finally finished having our children go through secondary education. I think one of the things that causes confusion to men is that we don't know who we are. And it's linked to that thing about peace. If we don't know who we are, then we can't be at peace. And if we don't know who we are, then we can't lead. And I think that's one of the most important things of all. And we need to know who we are in God.
That's right. I mean, that's what I'm trying to allude to in this idea that we've got to recognise that we're a spiritual being. You know, I mean, I think the essential part of knowing who we are is knowing what our relationship with God is, and that there is a God, you know, that we are children of God. Yeah, it's a start point to knowing who we are, I think. Yeah, I agree with it.
Just wave a hand or something and I'll try and get to you.
Thanks for that, Jim. I don't really know how to ask this question, but I was just thinking when you were saying that with the SAS, how they went out and they've killed 1,300 people. You felt very proud about that. How do you really stand about that, being as a Christian, knowing that your patrol, or whoever they are going out killing other human beings who God's created? How do you feel about that?
Okay, it's a good question, mate. I said to the pastor, I always get this question first usually, so this is the but this is a good question, you know. And every soldier has to reconcile himself to this question. It's central to whether or not as a Christian you believe you stay in the army or not. Let me tell you that I'll give you one example which is I think important to me in my coming to terms with this question. I had a friend of mine who was a great friend of mine, became a Christian at Duntroon about the same time, and he came to the opposite decision. He went off and was in an armoured unit, was a very, very good soldier. But he decided, because he was a Christian, he was a pacifist, and therefore he had to leave the army. He continued to come along to our Military Christian Fellowship, though, I think only to torture me, because he was always having a go at me about the fact that I'd stayed in the army. And so I said to him one day, I said, okay, Bob, I said, you know, if the enemy's coming down through Indonesia, you're not going to join the army. He said, no. And I said, okay. And I said, now they're coming down through Queensland. I said, you're going to join the army now? I knew he wouldn't, because he's a New South Welshman, wasn't going to defend Queensland. and he said no. And so I said, okay, now we're in the ACT in Canberra, and I said, okay, they're at the end of the street here. They're going to come down the street. They're going to have their way with your wife. They're going to kill your daughters. Are you going to join the army now to defend them, or are you going to stop them? And see, to hold true to his pacifist ideology or idea, he had to say no. Now, I don't know if that makes me better man, worse man. I really don't. I mean this, or better Christian, worse Christian. I don't know, you know. But what I know is I couldn't do that, you know. So if I are going to defend the family here, you know, then I'll accept a community responsibility to defend them when the enemy's out there, okay. So for me, the pacifist idea doesn't hold its validity, or it doesn't hold true right through, you know. So that's for me just one reason why I have no problem with that. Okay, yeah. So you got to remember too. Now I personally never killed anyone in my life, but and I must admit I always believe that God, and I believe this in everything I do, that God puts me everywhere where He wants me. You know, and. Yeah,
Jim, to any young fathers that are here, that the Christian experience is foreign, they're trying to... Oh, I'm sorry, beg your pardon. Did you hear me initially?
Yeah.
Right. The Christian experience is foreign. They're trying to find their own identification in the family unit, in leadership. How would you suggest you help them recognize their spiritual need in the midst of those three?
Recognize their spiritual need. Yeah. Well, you know, it gets back, I think, to that initial comment, and that is to me that our whole identity is in Christ, you know. Our whole purpose is in Christ. God's the creator, and He created man as the head of the family. And we can deny all that, but it doesn't change the fact that it's real. We can deny God, but it doesn't change the fact that God's there, you know. And so, to me, everything falls into order when we recognise God and His authority. And it doesn't matter whether it's in the nation or in a family, everything falls into order when we recognise God and His authority. And I might say in other things, which sometimes as Christians we don't think about as hard as we should and give as much time to as we should, but things like environmental issues, you know. Everything falls into order when we accept that God's the creator and He had a purpose for it all, and we need to consider that line as well, as much as we do, you know, in the nation state, the family, and all the other issues as too. Yeah. So it really, I don't think you can get around going to that as a start point. Yeah.
In the Australian Christian lobby, just changing the tack just for a moment, you're obviously in there plugging the Christian perspective in the political scene. Therefore, I presume you see religion and politics as being intermeshed. Mm. Therefore, I presume you would say it's fair that any religion can pressure politicians. Mm. A couple of questions. Do you see other religious leaders lobbying actively our Australian politicians in a real sense? And secondly, do you see the Christian foundations of Australia at a political level being washed away, again, in a real sense, or is it more of just a gut feel? Mm. Can you actually give some examples of where Christian foundations are being eroded?
Okay. Well, let me say, first of all, that just to define where I stand on this thing of, as you said, church and state being intermeshed, you know, I don't see them being intermeshed. I see that as Christians, and I think the great strength of Western civilization and Christendom, if you like, has been that Christian faith has accepted the division, separation of church and state to this degree that you give unto God what is God's and Caesar what is Caesar's, you know? So we don't believe in the Christian faith in the way that the Islamics do, for instance, that government and the church are all one, you know? Or everything comes under the church. We don't believe that. And I think it's healthy that we don't. Because I think Christ's example to us was that, you know, and that's why he gave us that under God and under God what is God's and under Caesar what is Caesar's. But to answer your question about lobbying into the parliament, yes, I do see, though, that when we say we have a separation of church and state, we shouldn't fall for this nonsense, which people try to make us fall for, that means that we shouldn't try to influence the church, you know? We've got to influence the church. And if you were Satan sitting up there and you wanted to take over and have the major influence over the government of the country, what would you tell Christians or the church? You'd say, separation of church and state, stay out of this, you know? But it doesn't mean that we shouldn't be influencing the church. Otherwise, you disenfranchise not just the church and not just Christians, but every person in Australia who believes in what they do from a Christian perspective. And that's most of them, you know? So I certainly believe that we need to be influencing it, and also because when people say to us, don't legislate your morality on me, the part that's left unanswered at the end of that is that somebody's morality is going to be legislated. See, they don't want your morality legislated, they don't want the church's morality legislated, but they want their morality legislated. So again, if you were the devil and you were trying to keep the church out of influencing things, what would you be saying? Don't legislate your morality on me, you know? And the church has tended to run into a little hole in the side of the wall instead of standing up and saying, no, you know, we've got a right to see our morality influencing the parliament as well. Now, in terms of other religions and how they're doing it at the moment, are doing that, I think you find that because they lack the legitimate effect in the legitimate constituency to actually impact on politics in a big way through the polls, what they do is that, and this is pretty universal, is they do it by financial contributions to parties. Yeah? And so there is a lot of influence that's brought to bear through financial contributions to parties, and they do it to both sides, you know, at least the ones I'm thinking of as I talk do it to both sides. Is this a big problem at the moment? No, it's not, you know, because in the end it's still votes that count more than financial contributions to parties in the end. So it's not a big problem as long as the people who have Christian values, this Christian constituency, stands up and says, we are a Christian constituency and we want you to win our vote. And if we say, not like in America, where it's just coming, you know, we say in America, they've just allowed one side of politics to grab the Christian vote, but instead we stand up in the centre of politics and say to both parties, you win our vote, you know, and stay engaged with both parties. And then on the election day, make our decision and let them know we're making our decision from a faith perspective, you know. And so I don't think at the moment that the various smaller religions in Australia, even the Islamic religion, which is getting lots and lots of publicity at the moment, and of course will grow exponentially because of the demographics, but at the moment it's not a real problem. I think you will see, I'd be very surprised in the next federal election, and I haven't looked at your state election here in this regard, but certainly in the next federal election, I'd be very surprised you don't see an Islamic elected into the parliament. I'd be very surprised. Hmm. Yeah. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. Jim, I'll just exercise my rights here for a moment. How do you read what's just happened in America? Is God punishing George Bush with these midterm electoral results? What do you think?
Yeah. Look, I must admit, on if I suppose that punishment would be for Iraq. Are you talking about, mate? Or
Iraq's in there, but
yeah,
George has a very strong sense that he's the president of America by God's calling.
Yeah. Let me say that I've spoken to people who know George Bush and have fellowshipped with him, and you've got a bloke there who is a fair dinkum evangelical Christian. Okay. And you know, we might look at the decisions he's made and doubt that, but I've got to tell you, I cannot see how anyone who's the President of the United States, who's just had 3,000 people killed by two planes going into Twin Towers, who's faced with the possibility that you might have that you're going to have further terrorist attacks on America, and that if weapons of mass destruction are part of that, and remember, you've got two things racing at the moment. You've got proliferation of weapons of mass destruction technology in the world, and we've seen that. You just got to look, North Korea now, Iran, you know, and it'll just keep going. So you've got proliferation. The other thing you've got racing is miniaturization as a technology. I mean, everything's getting miniaturized. So when you've got those two things racing ahead and about to intersect at some point, not too far in the future, and you've got all these people out there who hate you, and remember that these terrorists are a little bit different. These terrorists have not actually put any demands out there. Right? You seen any demands from Al-Qaeda? They haven't got any demands. They just hate us, you know. So it becomes very hard to negotiate with someone who's got no demands, you know. So if I was the President of the United States, sitting there in that situation, and I had intelligence, which we all look back on now and say, oh, you should have known that wasn't true, but, you know, my smarter blokes than you and I were looking at this, and smarter blokes than you and I decided it was true, that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. I think on the basis of the information he had there, I think there was no other decision that he could make, quite honestly. Do I think God's punishing George Bush? I would say that knowing George Bush's personal faith, from what has been reported to me by people who fellowship with him, I don't necessarily think so. Yeah.
Might have time for one or two more.
We seem to know the We seem to know the possibilities of winning by war, to the extent that our Minister of Defence has suggested that Year 12 students could have a year in army or military service. Would it not be wiser to have Year 12 students be in diplomatic posts around the world, that they may be experienced as peacemakers?
Yeah, look, I guess this goes back to the question before, and that is, do you see a role for force and armies, you know, in a Christian world? Well, I think Romans 13 tells us there is, you know, authorities wield the sword. So I think that, yes, certainly, there is a role for that. It's a bit hard to see that you could get... I don't think they're talking about Year 12s, are they? They're talking about the fellows that just got out of Year 12 before they go to university. But it's a bit hard to see that those sort of people could be absorbed by the diplomatic service around the country. Certainly they could be encouraged into Greenpeace or, you know, various other peace organisations. But an army can absorb those people because of the level at which they're going to be operating. They're going to be operating as diplomats, they're going to be operating as soldiers, you know. So, I suppose to ask the unasked question, I think there is a role for force in a fallen world, and there's a role for force by Christian governments. I think as we're threatened by Islam in particular, more and more, that we're going to find ourselves having to recourse more and more to force. And is it necessary? But might I say that you've got to resource smartly, you know, recourse smartly to war, because the reality is that force never wins anything. You know, it's only a means. It's a means to providing an environment in which a political solution or social injustice or economic injustice can be redressed, you know, to hold a lid on things while it's redressed. What happened in Iraq was that they had no plan for the peace, you know. Real, real dumb. I can tell you that as late as just before they went into Iraq, I know that the person, Joe Garner, who was the first administrator in Iraq after the war, was trying to hold meetings to get in all the key people from the administration who had to have an input into managing the peace after the war, and could not get anybody of any substance. He kept getting the underlings, you know. Now, all George Bush had to do was go to one of those meetings and everyone would have been there, you know. So there's a fundamental misunderstanding. And as a soldier schooled in this thing for years and years and years, I mean, we're taught this all the time. Right? We are not the answer, you know. And all we're doing is providing an environment in which they can address the problems. But they didn't set up the plan to address the problems, yeah. Unfortunately.
Yeah. We'll take this as the last question.
Yeah, my ice cream's melting.
G'day, Jim. Rick Molman. Thanks for your words tonight. You've alluded to some of the threats that are indeed maybe here today or certainly emerging and come closer. That would present an opportunity for an organisation like yourself as a an opportunity to exploit. So what have been your experiences to date engaging with both of the major parties? And can you provide some examples of wins that you've had and what you see is in the future?
Yeah. Yeah, okay. Well, certainly Australian Christian Lobby, as I mentioned before, absolutely believes it's got to engage with both sides of Parliament. I was in ANU giving a lecture last year, and a young fellow at the end of it put his hand up and he said, how much would be too much? You know? And I said, too much would be if we end up like America, you know, because I don't want to end up like America, where one side of politics has grabbed that Christian vote. So we are in there and we've developed relationships with both sides of politics. And we were in there just the other day, for instance. In the last 6 weeks, we conducted policy forums with the with Mr. Howard and his ministry, and then with Mr. Beasley and his shadow ministry. And, I mean, both these men pulled it up to their level, right? Amazing. And we took church leaders and parachurch leaders in to meet them separately and to tell them what they wanted to see in the next election, you know, what campaign policies they wanted to see from the churches and the parachurch groups. Now, there were all sorts of groups in there. There was all the MICA challengers and all the poverty groups and all the rest. There was, you know, all types of groups, all persuasions. And they were very, very successful and very, very well received by Labor and by Liberals, you know. So that's just one example. Now, in terms of wins, we quite honestly have wins all the time. The biggest win we had was in negotiating, or the biggest recent one, was in negotiating the amendment to the Marriage Act that saw marriage confirmed as between a man and a woman. Because that was lost for all money, you know. It was gone. And it was gone. And we, along with the Fatherhood Foundation and with the AFA, we decided to get as many people as we could to Canberra. It turned out 1,100 came. Other groups, not just ourselves, but other groups all helped with the Senate inquiry in getting responses to that. So that was a record by over... it was 16,074 submissions, which was a record by 2,000 and something. And so when I went in and sat down and negotiated with the Nicola Roxon, the Shadow Attorney General, her staff were all saying, the staff were saying, look, there's we can't count all the submissions. And I'm talking to her on the Monday after the submissions are closed on the Friday, and we've got our meeting on the next Wednesday. And the staff are saying that, and the staff are also telling that only 100 of those are from the homosexual community. They're saying on their own websites, you know. So she turned to me and she said, well, she said, I can see that the Christian lobby is much bigger than the homosexual lobby. Remember, we're 3 months out from an election here. And I said, yeah, I said, it is. And I said, I've got 28 church leaders and loads of people. I didn't know how many people at that stage coming in here on Wednesday. But I've got 28 church leaders who are going to come up here on Wednesday and they're going to tell you why marriage matters. And this is where they draw a line. And I was expecting to have a big argument with her. And she just said, okay, we'll do it, you know. So that was the biggest win. Another big recent win is that, we also knocked civil unions on the head the other day when it came through. We went up there into the parliament. Stanhope put it up. I went up at 7:30 in the morning, saw Senator Guy Barnett By 5:30 in the afternoon, he had the Prime Minister make a statement which said he was going to defeat it, you know, turn it over. So that was good. But to get off the sex, homosexual things anyway for a while, another one is the Officer Film and Literature Classification is a mess. It is ignoring the intent of its own guidelines. And to give you an example of that, its own guidelines say at the moment there's to be no live sex in R-rated movies. But there's a little let out which says, unless there's artistic merit. So you can imagine, they use that all the time. And so we went up into Parliament, we got a whole lot of the coalition ministers and senators, Christians, we got them together in a room, we showed them excerpts of some of these films, which I tell you, it is disgusting, you know. There's stuff in these R-rated movies that is not allowed in X-rated, because see, in X-rated there are controls. In R-rated it's not supposed to be there, so there's no controls. I mean, absolutely, unbelievably disgusting stuff. And the MPs and senators saw this and they said, stop. They said, not on our watch. And so we said, well, what you've got to do is you've got to change the Office of Film and Literature Classification guidelines, which is difficult, and we're working at that at the moment because we have to get the agreement of the state's attorney generals, so that's difficult. We need probably two more so far. We've got two. We need two more. And then the other thing is we said you've got to reorganise the Office of Film and Literature Classification, and here's the plan. And they took that plan up to the Attorney General, and he's implementing it. He's throwing the whole thing up in the air, and it'll be reorganised by the 1st of July next year, you know. So we are having real effect. And let me tell you that having real effect is about having relationships into the Parliament. We can send each other angry emails all day long. Makes no difference, you know. But having real effect is about having close relationships into the Parliament, on both sides of Parliament, so that you can have effect. And we're certainly finding that. I mean, in this cloning thing, very disappointing, this cloning thing, because we had no chance of winning this. We were probably 26 was the most votes we were going to get. But we worked with a great coalition of politicians and other churches and various people into the Parliament, and have been working extremely hard over the last weeks. And the result was that we got within one vote. And we should have got that vote. We had it tied in, and someone got to him. Nick Sherry, Labor in Tasmania. Someone got to him the night before, and we lost him. But we should have had, you know, really, the Greens should have come across, you know, because yeah, they're against genetic engineering of food, and yet they allow cloning of a human being, you know. Andrew Bartlett, you heard him say in the press, you know, that he's not sure he voted the right way. For goodness sake, you know. It was his vote that, or Nick Sherry's, or just any one of those that come across, we would have defeated it, you know. So we've been, you know, I can say that God's really blessed us. And he's given us real opportunities. It's just been amazing. And we are having a lot of effect in there. Hmm.
A lot of gelati when it starts melting, isn't it? Isn't it great to hear from someone who knows deeply what God has done for him personally, and has been probably had his nose rubbed in the poo, literally maybe, and has seen people at risk, lives lost, commanded people to put their lives at risk, put his own life at risk, is now engaging at the most senior level in our country and having to think about things as diverse as marriage relationships and censorship and cloning and all these enormously complicated ethical questions, and trying to find a voice into the country when there are so many competing voices. So those of you who believe in the power of prayer, I'd like to encourage you to pray for Jim and pray for the Australian Christian Lobby. And not only that, but pray for our politicians. I think for those men and women who are elected to represent us at both Canberra and then for us who are Victorians in Melbourne, I mean, how much training do they get to make these sorts of decisions, and how qualified are they? And so they need our prayers as well, despite or regardless of what particular political persuasion you personally have. Jim, we want to thank you. I've got a little gift that I'll give you later. And we want to thank you that you put yourself under pressure to come here today.
We want to thank your wife and tell her, look, if she works out the secret to your drawers, there are a few other wives in this room who'd probably appreciate knowing that secret as well. And we'd like to thank your wife and your girls for letting us have you for this weekend. And again, I'd invite you, any of you who'd like to come tomorrow morning to hear Jim. So let's put our hands together and thank Jim again.
Can I just come? Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Could I just say, I really appreciate it being here, so thank you very much. It's great to talk to a group of men like this. Could I just put one final ad in? We've got at the moment, as you know, the Victorian election. Of course, you know better than I do. And we do hold Meet Your Candidate forums for the elections where we get all the candidates along and we encourage the churches to get along and to participate in these Meet Your Candidate forums. They're extremely well run and we make sure that nobody's embarrassed, that all the candidates go away feeling that they've been honoured as well. But you'll go away knowing what they stand for, which is really important. But equally important, by being there, you will show that the Christian constituency is a thinking one and one that has to be satisfied. So I'd really encourage, I reckon it's a responsibility as much as a right, you know, to be at these things. If you get onto the Australian Christian Lobby website, which you can Google or you can just go www.acl.org.au, you get onto that, you'll be able to see where they are. But you've got one in this area somewhere this week coming up. And I'd really encourage you to think about going to it.
Thanks a lot. Jim will be speaking at 9 o'clock and 11 o'clock. I've just been reminded I hadn't told you those times. All you've got to do now is enjoy yourselves. Feel free to get up and wander around. I'm sure Jim would be happy once he's had his gelati to talk to any of you. And thank you again for coming and hope you've had a great night. Take the opportunity maybe to introduce yourself to someone you haven't met before. Okay, God bless. Thank you very much.